You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. I am Large William. Across the border from me, eating caramels, is my good pal, the Sammy.
Hey, what's going on? It's a phone recording week again. It's one of those weeks.
Yeah, it's life gets in the way of podcasting. So normally the day we record is Sundays, 5 a.m., as most of you listen know. But I was quite sick this week, so I had to pull the plug. Then Sunday night didn't work for the same reasons. Monday night, I was at work. And here we are Tuesday, and this episode, this almost, if we were made of softer fiber, we wouldn't be recording right now because of a mishap off offset, as it were.
Yeah.
But we are professionals, and the show must go on. And all the more reason for us to go on is the fact that this is our very first episode that's being sponsored by the great people over at Olive Films. We had a chance to reach out to them, and, you know, to be forthright, I've always had a couple Olive Films in my catalog, some Jerry Lewis stuff, and we've even done a couple Olive Films catalog picks over the years, Uptight, the Jules Descend film, and, you know, a couple other things, but it wasn't until Sammy and I went through their catalog and we saw stuff like The Boogans and Perfect Weapon and a few other films, we thought, wow, they got a really deep Monster Squad. You know, a bunch of Godard, a bunch of John Ford, that they had really a lot of stuff going on that was in line with what we talk about, which is the class, the trash, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. So what we had done was we had decided that, you know, since I had initially engaged with them and in the interest of minimizing mailing, I picked the first four films, which will be the first two episodes, and Sammy will do the next four films. So the first episode, as you would have heard if you listened last week, we are doing from 1954, Nicholas Ray's classic Johnny Guitar, starring John Crawford, Sterling Hayden, and a boatload of other people. And a film that certainly takes place, I guess, also in the West. If you fast forward about 35 years.
Yeah.
Nowhere near as well known.
Yeah. Don't have Ernest Borgnine coming in to relieve that ninth inning in that one, though.
No, definitely not, man. Definitely not. But it was a film that, going through the catalog, to pull back the curtain again, I'd seen the poster was a baseball with, on the end of a hook, a man for a hook for a hand, or presumably a man, we should say, with a hook through their hand. I saw that. I said, Sammy, have you seen this? I'd never even heard of it, and neither had I. So it's 1989's Peter Masterson, Roy Scheider starring Night Game. So, yeah, that's what we're covering. We're happy to be here. We're happy to present you with an Olive Films episode monthly. They've been very good to us, you know, very pleased to say that, and given us a lot of opportunity. They've even extended that to Todd, writing on our blog. He wrote a review for Caveman from their catalog. He'll also be bringing a monthly review. So head over there and check that out. And whether it's his Olive review or something else, Todd would appreciate the feedback. He's been doing yeoman's work for us for years.
Yep.
So without further ado, my man, what have you been watching?
Well, I've watched a few things. Just a couple of mostly just I know this is going to stun a lot of our listeners, and I'm sure it's going to stun you too, but mostly documentaries. And that's just because I've been really busy. And, you know, again, documentaries are a great kind of way to kind of receive information and kind of watch a film, but I have to always worry about the visuals. But so one of them, one or two of them I did watch very closely. I watched My Life, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, which
yes.
I think you watched as well.
I also watched it this week. It debuted on Instant this week.
Yes. I was going to rent it not too long ago, and I'm kind of glad. The reason why I held off is because it's only about an hour long. And I thought, well, you know, that might pop up somewhere soon. Some of these hour-long documentaries sometimes pop up on Hulu or Netflix or some streaming service somewhere. So I thought I'd wait. Well, you know, the gods were shining on me, I guess, because it did pop up on Netflix. I saw some other people said it popped up, so I was like, hey, I'm going to check that out. It's pretty good. I think I wanted, you know, I could have stood another half an hour of things, or, you know, or more. I like the, I guess my favorite parts of it are the, I like the family life. His family life is both interesting and very, you know, of course it's realistic because his wife is documenting him working on Only God Forgives. But, I mean, it's just like chaos. You know, he's working, kids are running around nude. I mean, it's absolute chaos, as you know, if you're a parent, as you know, it can easily turn into that in the span of 10 minutes.
I think it was very, I think, true to form for parenthood. I had to laugh when his, I guess, about 1.5-year-old daughter is dancing naked or running around on a table naked as he's just nonchalantly discussing something. And that's kind of encapsulates parenting and trying to work at home sometimes when you have young children. So
I think he was trying to prep like a food of some sort, like maybe a coconut
maybe so.
Or something.
Yeah, maybe so, but it was hilarious. You know, he doesn't even bat an eyelash. But again, that's kind of how it is.
That's kind of how it is, right?
Yeah.
I really like the dynamic of the and you could kind of chime in on this one too if you want to, since you already watched as well. I did like the dynamic of his wife and him. I mean, it's pretty raw. They get into some arguments. You know, she supports him. Jodo shows up in there, which is interesting because he's really tight with Jodorowsky, and he has some interesting things to say. And it's good. I feel like, you know, it should have been on the Only God Forgives Blu-ray. It does feel like one of those kind of Blu-ray documentaries, or just like a bonus feature, not really so much a film. But in saying that, it does the service. I got to say, the lucky director's blanket is a fashion faux pas for me.
Yeah, I can't get down with that. You know, the Gosling makes an appearance. And I had to give credit to William because I had it paused at one moment when they came in because I was watching it when the in-home was home. And he came in and goes, oh, look, what's that Scottish man doing? Yeah. You know, I said, I'm impressed you put two together. You saw this kind of tartan print on this man's lower section. But yeah, I can't get into that. An Eastern thing. It keeps your, what do you say, is your chi? He didn't say chi, I don't think, but.
Well, I think Gosling did say chi.
Oh, Gosling says, yeah, right. But I would agree with you. I think this one would make a nice little supplemental on a disc. I don't think it's tremendous as a standalone, but it's cool that his wife took the reins and he allowed a little more access into kind of the neuroses and the insecurities as a director through his creative process.
I would have never known from interviews I've seen with Nicholas Winding Refn, and we've done a lot of his films on the show, and we're both big fans of his work, I would have never known he was as insecure as he is.
He comes across very intellectual and confident in interviews, but it's, you know, I guess it's that thing he's projecting something, much like he has to be on set, you know, projecting. And there's a few great kind of nuts and bolts scenes, like when they get down to the last plate glass they have to, you know, to use for a scene. And it's definitely good, but you know, to be transparent, it wouldn't make like a top 30 list or anything for me, but a good way to spend an hour for sure.
It is a good way to spend an hour. It's actually the first time I've ever heard Nicholas Winding Refn talk in his native tongue.
Yeah. Yeah. He speaks a lot of Danish in it, which is cool.
Speak Danish, it's usually just, you know, bear claw.
Cheese with cheese. They got Nutella Danish just coming here to Tim Hortons, man.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, now we're talking. I've been dieting lately, so Danish has not been in the vocabulary much lately outside of Refn. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was that. I watched one you watched last week, I Hate Christian Leitner, which was also good.
Yes.
I agree with you. Maybe more for a sports fan than for like a non-sports fan documentary, because it kind of really gets into the kind of weirdness of fan culture sometimes.
And where were you at these pivotal sports moments type thing?
Yeah. And, of course, you know, whenever people start talking about, you know, hating an athlete, you know, it always gets into like their own psychosis a little bit. And
it does.
The strangest. And they talk to people in here who wrote books, you know, that I've seen on shelves, because here in Kentucky, Leitner has a bit of a history.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I've seen the books and stuff. Duke sucks and you know, I hate Duke and all this other stuff. And you know, but it gets into that. I wish you would have got a little bit more into that fan stuff, but I did like, it was good. It was good. It's on Netflix Instant as well, but I recorded it and watched it, and it was good. It was good. And, Leitner comes across as very, you know, like I've seen in interviews in the past, laid back and, you know, just a regular guy. It just so happens that he played a role.
Not the yuppie scum that...
Yeah,
people wanted to paint him out to be.
Yeah, it was very strange, and you know, but that's, you know, that's been an image Duke has lived with for years. Only in recent years, I think, have they gotten away from that. But they've lived with that image for quite some time. So, but anyway, it is good. But I do agree with you. You know, I think more for a sports fan, or more for especially maybe a basketball fan or college sports fan.
Yeah,
maybe more up their alley than you know, somebody who just doesn't really. Watch documentaries because of the filmmaking and stuff, because the filmmaking, it's good, but it's a very much a highlight reel documentary, you know? So, and then the only other thing I watched Enron, the Smartest People in the Room, which is one I've watched before, Alex Gibney documentary from, I can't believe this movie's 10 years old already.
Wow.
And, I like it quite a bit. It's one of my favorite of the Gibney documentaries. He directs quite a few of them, and it's one of my favorite. It's a great look at how greed and things go really wrong really quickly. So really, really crazy stuff. But I just kind of rewatched that on a lamb. And I watched a few other things. We should probably mention that we both kind of watched the buzzworthy show of the week. I guess we watched a couple episodes. I watched four. I don't know how many you've watched.
I've watched two, but of course, with the return to Westeros, that's kind of put the brakes on Hell's Kitchen for a few weeks.
Yeah, but we can. You know, we both watched the first two episodes, and I got to say, you know, it's good. I'm not in love with it after two. And I won't talk about the third and fourth episode, although I will say I really love the fourth episode.
Oh, isn't that with when Fisk gets to really – and Fisk, of course, Kingpin, Vincent D'Onofrio's character, the heavy of the show. I should say, I don't think we outright said it, for those that maybe don't know what show we're referring to Daredevil, the Marvel property that's on Netflix.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just kind of – everybody's kind of joining in. It's kind of one of these social media events, you know. It's kind of one of those things. So I think it's kind of worth talking about. That.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I like the way it's went. I've always thought that characters like Daredevil, Punisher, and characters like that, since they can't really bring across the excessive violence so much in the comic, on the film. I mean, I think they can, but it ends up being something like, you know, Warzone or something like that, as opposed to, you know, the standard comic book fare type thing.
That's right.
And it's hard, you know, hard to get that released and kind of sell that. So, you know, this is a great idea to use these more adult themed comics into a series, especially one like Netflix, which doesn't have to abide by any, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Jesus, I can't, censorship.
That's right. Exactly. Not at all. We've seen some pretty shocking stuff on Netflix, and it's a smart model for Marvel, and it absolutely, and even not just for kind of risque content as far as comics go, but risky content, meaning some kind of B-side type characters. Like they're even putting out an Iron Fist show, and listen, I mean, people that have a familiarity with comics will know Iron Fist, but you know, I can promise you, you know, John Q. Public isn't going to know who the fuck Iron Fist is.
Yeah. My son happens to know who Iron Fist is because of my love of Iron Fist.
Yeah,
you know, if he's around other kids, like today when I picked him up, he was using freeze powers on some kids in school. I don't know what character he was portraying. But at some point, I hear him say, I'm going to break the ice and freeze Iron Fist.
Nice.
And I was like, now all the other kids are looking at him like, that must be a special move. And I'm sitting there thinking, no. He knows who Iron Fist is.
Yeah, no, I get that too. My kids will pull out a deep cut and it'll go kind of crickets. But I'm like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That moment of pride.
Yeah.
He might not have a girlfriend until he's 17. But hey, that's okay. Yeah, it's a good show. I think it's gotten better as I've watched. I usually, any show for me is, about four episodes to really kind of get a feel of how it's going to be. And the fourth episode was the best episode for me so far. So, I'm looking forward to kind of riding it out and checking it out. And I know some of our listeners, some of our very close friends on the show really loved it. But yeah. It is fun. I got to say, it's nice to see. And personal confession here, Daredevil's actually my favorite Marvel character.
He's one always of mine, too. He's top, he's top three or four for me, too.
Yeah. And I was hoping this show would do right by him because, of course, being a favorite, it would, it'd be heartbreaking for me. But it seems to be going in the right directions. I'm looking forward to Scott Glenn coming in as Stick and some other stuff. So we'll see what happens.
And we should say the kid, I say kid, he's probably around our age or in between our age or something, maybe a few years younger than us, but that plays Matt Murdock, the titular Daredevil, I think he really is the anchor. I mean, as far as from an acting, I haven't seen Don't Know If You're yet, and I know he's going to blow the roof off, but I think they were perfectly cast this kid from England. I think he's wonderful as Murdock, brings a humanity and likability to the role, and it's... he's good. Foggy, I'm still not quite fully all in with Foggy, but, that's the way it goes. But, yeah, and the choreography is great, too. But, we could talk about that. I'm sure we'll mention it again at some point.
Right.
That was it for you, right, you said?
Yeah, that was it. Nice. Yeah, and D'Onofrio does make some very interesting acting choices. You'll see. You'll see when you get there.
Outstanding. So my week, I guess it was okay, relatively speaking, but it felt light just because I worked, extra and... Easter was last week and, busy with things. I did one that I'd seen. I subscribed to the Video Force 1980 YouTube channel and one called The Executioner Part 2. And they've said literally the best movie ever. So I thought, well, surely this has to be worth my 90 minutes. And it's pretty terrible, man. It feels like a really lazy... I think it's Italian. However, it really feels like an early 80s lazy Filipino actioner, like a Richard Harrison joint. It's got Chris Mitchum, in a mustache. It's very lazy. With 80s kind of world action, the macaroni combat, the Italian stuff and Indonesian stuff, I expect, even the Filipino stuff, I expect a certain level, but it just felt like a Richard Harrison joint. So I really didn't like that at all. I was very disappointed. Then I watched a film that I don't know if you've seen yet, but it was one of those ones that it really divided a lot of our friends and our listenership and our community and genre film fans. And I watched it with my wife last Wednesday night. It was John Wick.
I haven't seen it yet.
I'll say this about Wick. I'll say this about Keanu very quickly. I think as a person, I wish everyone in Hollywood was like him because by all accounts, he's a wonderful human being. He's gracious. He's humble. He's giving, just a kind, good person, which the world, not just Hollywood, but the world would be better served to have more people like. As an action hero, he gives it his all. But in saying that, I don't find him quite convincing enough to be – menacing as the world's greatest hitman.
Yeah.
The film itself is solid. It's like 6.5, maybe 7 territory for me. The choreography is decent. It's a stylish film. I like that they create this world with, kind of safe and not safe houses, but currency for hitmen and, hotel. There's a lot of this whole underground kind of this cottage industry where, cleanup crews come to take care of bodies and, it's got a good fun cast. And it's fine. But I wouldn't – some people were saying it was the action film of the year. It's like, did no one see The Raid 2 last year?
I don't think anybody – I started to think nobody did.
Apparently not. I can tell you – and again, respectfully, to those that really love Wick. Wick to me, it's not even in the same league. But, yeah. Wick's fine. It is fine on its own merit. Shift of gears. I just wanted something older and pulpy. I wanted to do. Actually, I wanted to do something French, and I started watching. Like, man, this isn't French at all. It was Blast of Silence.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
From I guess about 61, or I don't know, somewhere in that area. Hitman, I guess
63,
maybe. Yeah, Hitman returns to New York City and gets distracted along the way, trying to do a few things. He's from Cleveland. This is fantastic. I'd said to you, it really is the kind of film I could tell that, you know, Marty Scorsese was influenced by when he made Taxi Driver. I get a strong Taxi Driver vibe from it. Tarantino's clearly a fan. It just seems like the kind of film that influenced a lot of people that came after this. Very, very cool. It's only about 80 minutes. High recommend for me. I'll probably buy it at the next Criterion sale. I really dug it, and it would be fun to talk about at some point.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Very good one. Next up was a French one. I don't remember how I'd heard about it, but I'd had it, and I was like, I got to watch this. And it kind of was ironic because it created the second film in my unintentional boy orphan double with Blast of Silence. And it was Son of the Shark. It's a French film, early 90s, about two young brothers in the French countryside. They are just hell on wheels, these two young boys. They're about anywhere from 7 to 10 years old. I mean, they just destroy everything. They steal. They run away from everywhere they go. It's a good film. I wanted a little more from it in terms of plumbing the depths emotionally. But it is good, certainly. So, yeah, I caught that. It was solid. Next up was kind of a Seven Samurai riff with an all-female team of kickboxers called Sweet Revenge. This one's fun. This one's fun. I had a lot of fun with it. You know, perfect kind of Sunday afternoon fare. I did the Refn one. We spoke about that. And then I did a couple Louis Theroux documentaries, because I tend to go on runs with him. He's one of my favorite documentarians. I did one. I watched one that he had done on transgendered children. It's his most recent one. And it's certainly very fascinating, and it's a hard watch at times. You know, you see what some of these kids are going through, and thankfully a lot of the children featured, you know, have good parents in their lives, but there's a lot of kids that don't, that are going through some things. And, you know, it's a, you know, kind of a foggy sea that parents and children alike are trying to navigate through these waters. But Louis treats it with the kind of respect and dignity it deserves. So, yeah, it was a good one. And then next up was one I liked even more. It was a two-parter. It was, I think, the most recent one prior to Transgender Children one. I believe it's called By Reason of Insanity. And he does a lot of stuff where, you know, he looks at the institution of prisons and penal life and, of course, P-E-N-A-L, not P-E-N-I-L-E, life. And
Yeah.
But this one looks at people with varying degrees of mental illness and how they were found not guilty or in the midst of being found fit to stand trial, as opposed to being found by reason of insanity. And, you know, mental illness is it's a very complicated thing. The human brain's a complicated thing. And to try to kind of make sense of some things when there's not a lot of sense to be made is, you know, he does a great job of it though. And, you know, he has a nature that really allows people to open up. And yeah, it was good though. Definitely a strong recommend for me. I quite liked it. So that was my week.
Nice. Are those Theroux documentaries on YouTube? I know he puts a lot of his stuff up on YouTube sometimes.
They're on the BBC player.
Okay.
And I think they're both on Daily Motion though.
Yeah. Yeah, they sometimes pop up on there too. Yeah, I watch. I go on runs with his stuff too because he sometimes makes longer features and sometimes makes short features.
Yeah. So. Yeah, he's great. He's definitely one of my favorite documentarians. He's kind of got it down real well. I feel like he's not overtly political. I think it's apparent which way his politics lean without being heavy-handed about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, yeah. I think as is the way a lot of time with British journalism, right? Like, I feel like they get it right, you know, a lot of times. I mean, there's some rags in Britain that are pretty shameless leaning one way or the other. But I feel like this is, you know, he's a solid journalist, so.
Those aren't those rags like Red Waffle Paul's always posting about somebody shitting in a buffet, is it?
Oh, man, yeah. Those newspapers. That dude needed some, not Paul, but that dude that shit in the buffet needed some rags, man. Clean that ass.
I got to be honest with you. Jeez. If somebody's shitting in a buffet, that's news I need to know.
It is. Because I don't want to go anywhere fucking near that restaurant. Yes, you already got to bring your A game if I'm going to do buffet. I mean, buffet was cool when I was a teenager, man. You know, and don't get me wrong. There's a buffet here, Buffet Chain Mandarin. It's a higher end buffet chain. It's good. You know, the attention to detail and stuff. But I'll tell you what, if I set foot in a buffet and it looks ropey, man, I'm out the door so fast.
Yeah, it can be tricky.
And buffets can be a bad move. And
if roll the dice.
And if a dude's shitting by the waffle table, man, get out now. You know, because you are inviting horror, unmentionable horror, if you allow that. You know, but we're going to get off the waffle table and the crepe table with the dookie, and we're going to take a short break and come back and talk about Mercedes McCambridge, who treats everyone like Dookie and Johnny Guitar, Nicholas Ray's 1954 classic. We will be right back.
This is Reb Brown. You're listening to Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema.
Bring me to Dakota!
Welcome back, everyone. Our first film this evening is Nicholas Ray's 1954 cult classic. I think it's crossed over and probably just considered a classic, Johnny Guitar, American Republic Pictures Western.
That's a good point you make. Started out maybe as a cult classic, but now I think in today's standards, it's kind of seen as a classic anymore. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think it certainly has. And it's that thing of, interestingly, with Criterion and a lot of labels, having films like Houssou, and this isn't a culty in that way, but I think our generation, the VHS generation and so forth, have, and you know, we look at people like Jodorowsky and Almodovar, people that maybe in previous generations would have been kind of viewed as trashy filmmakers in some respects. They're being considered as masters of film. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think this kind of falls into that thing where, you know, Ray makes this film, and at the time it was a bizarre sell. I can only imagine. And, you know, we have it. So both of us had seen this film before, certainly. And I'd said it was the first film I ever watched with my youngest son, Braden, when he was about a month old in my arms. I say watched. I mean, more of a symbolic watch than anything. I didn't.
And I always remind people that yours was Johnny Guitar and mine was Ferdalance.
Which is amazing. Which is amazing. Amazing. As I still haven't seen, man, I'll tell you what. Sammy Jr., I won't mention names here, he's got a one up on me because I still haven't seen Ferdalance, man.
Well, neither is he, technically.
So. Yeah, good point. Good point. But, yeah, and then William I had Unseen in the Rain with. So it's yeah, but John, when I'd seen that all of it had this in the catalog, I really wanted to review it because I feel like, you know, you're a big Western guy. I love Westerns, and I love seeing genres being really subverted and kind of turned on their ear. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Ray is a filmmaker he's really – I don't know that we've ever done a Nicholas Ray film, have we?
We have not.
Yeah, which I mean,
he's been in a film that we covered, An American Friend.
Yeah, that's right.
He was in that.
He was.
And he's kind of been on the periphery as far as influence and some of the filmmakers we've covered, but we've never really talked about Nicholas Ray, no.
He's certainly influenced, a lot of the people we've whose films we reviewed. It's ironic that Johnny Guitar Watson was on our show before Johnny Guitar.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But, nice. So I think I said I was going to lead on this, so I'll let you synopsize, and then I'll kind of tear into it here.
Well, I don't have a synopsis available in front of me right now.
So I do. That's right.
As well.
I will. Let me just see here. Okay.
Yeah, I could probably pull one up, but I'm afraid it'll mess up our Skype call.
No call. No, I was going to say no calls. No worries. A strong-willed female saloon owner is wrongly suspected of murder and bank robbery by a lynch mob when she helps a wounded gang member. So, yeah, that, I guess, is a synopsis of sorts. I got to say, this was a film, too, that not only did we finally do it, but it was great to see this film on blue, because I think it's a film whose reputation as being a good-looking film certainly precedes it. And, you know, when we talk about Holy Grails for the medium of Blu-ray, this was one that I always would mention alongside, Dick Tracy and a number of others. I can't think of it off the top of my head just because it's late in the evening and My mind's not working as it should, but this was definitely one that I felt was crying out for a Blu-ray. And I'm glad that it got that treatment from Olive.
It's shot in a process known as True Color, I think is what it was called back in the 50s. I don't really know much about it, and I don't have the benefits of the internet to make me sound like I'm a filmmaking genius, but that's what I do know. I do know that it was shot in True Color, and I know that because of Marty Scorsese's introduction, which I watched. So,
which is a nice little introduction, and Marty is pretty active, especially as he gets older, and I think he's trying to leave his legacy not only with his own films, but his love of film and appreciation of film and cultivating and curating film. Mm-hmm. He gives a great little introduction to this film, which is the only feature on the thing, because Olive has often said they tend to put their money into putting out the best version of the film possible, which when you're a boutique label, you kind of got to pick what you're going to do. And I feel like that's a wise choice for anyone. I mean, I think the most important thing is the film.
Yeah. Well, I think they're starting to come around, where they're making some special features and things and starting to do more and more of that stuff, which is something labels do. So I think they're, for those that are looking for that stuff, I mean, I think, you'll find it in some releases. Kino Lorber's going through that. They're starting to put stuff out with features. And I think that we'll see more and more of that because I think, the boutique labels, it's sad to say, but I think the boutique labels for film lovers are going to be the labels of the future because I don't really think the studios are going to release stuff anymore.
No, they're just going to probably run their own streaming service, much like some of them are doing now, or they're going to be in bed with, Netflix and what have you. There's so many out there, Amazon Prime and
You'll Hulu. Still see new releases and big releases, I think, and kids' movies and things like that. But they're not going to, I just don't think there's a market, and it's sad to say this, but I just don't really think there's a gigantic market for, maybe for Johnny Guitar, maybe more so, but certainly not Night Game. So, I can see why the boutique labels are picking up stuff like this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to talk about the cast of this film for a minute. Joan Crawford, a heavyweight of Hollywood. Sterling Hayden, who's been on our show a number of times, everything from the Booze Fest, feverish, insane Booze Fest with Klaus Kinski and Ollie Reed. I think it's Hiss. Or Slither or Venom. I mean, it's one of those.
I don't think I reviewed that film with you guys, but I remember you guys.
Which is
talking
too bad.
About.
But man, I think that was that director's first film. What a hornet's nest to walk into on your first film. Yeah, not one, really. But three of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
It's unbelievable. But this, I think, was a little bit more of a more upright Hayden, I would imagine.
Yeah. He's he's younger here, and he did a lot of films in the beginning. He kind of became, I guess, disenfranchised with Hollywood after a while.
Yeah.
But, even he would say it pays well, so that's why he kept doing it and stuff and, kind of afforded him the luxury to sail around on his boat and smoke a lot of pot and drink a lot and do all that kind of stuff. But, I know that after this movie, though, he said he'd never work with Joan Crawford again. So
I can imagine that might have been a bit difficult, which is kind of interesting when you see the film because they are love interests in the film.
Yeah. I think everybody on this film swore up and down they never worked with Joan Crawford again. But evidently, and I didn't know this. I thought it came with later films, but she was incredibly difficult on this film to the point of, some trivia that I read said that she at one point tore all of Mercedes McCambridge's costumes up.
Ooh, man. And you can't imagine that. The thing is, like, Ray, even back then, he wasn't like Capra or one of these filmmakers or Ford in the genre or Hawks or someone that had a big budget.
I don't even think Ray really caught on. I know he had some hits, but I don't think he really caught on until the kind of French auteurs started
Godard
singing.
And people like that really
they started
really
singing
them.
How important he was.
I you know who I always kind of lump in with Ray, rightly or wrong, I think it's because the period and how I think they're so important to kind of smaller film and our artistic film in America of the 50s and early 60s is I always kind of lump them in with Sam Fuller.
Yeah.
Two to me, they subvert a lot and they, they kind of look beyond and even, Circa, I guess to a lesser degree, but just looking beyond kind of the veneer, certainly. And you got Mercedes McCambridge in here, who's, I guess, the heavy of the film. Well-respected actress, certainly. And she, I had said to you, it to me is very evident, or it's evident to me that, and I forgot her name when I'd said it to you, unfortunately, the Mist, the religious zealot.
Oh, the Marcia Gay Harden
character. The Marcia Gay Harden character, I feel like, really rips a page out of the Mercedes McCambridge playbook.
Yeah. Mercedes McCambridge fucking hates saloons, man.
She fucking hates saloons. Hates saloons. It's unbelievable. But we got her. We got Ward Bond, who, you know, a classic actor. If you've seen Westerns, I mean, I think Ward Bond's been on our show before, though.
He may have popped up on something before, but yeah, Ward Bond, mostly known for, you know, playing that guy in Westerns, usually sheriffs, marshals. Yeah.
Always.
A real good friend of John Wayne and John Ford's. So.
Oh, yeah. And I love Ward Bond. Whenever I see him show up, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
He's great.
Sadly, he died pretty young. He died in his 50s, I think. So.
That's too bad. Too bad. Ben Cooper, the Fountain of Youth himself, Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
He looks about 40 in this one. And this was like 1954, I think. Was it a 53?
Yeah, this was before Bad Day at Black Rock. And I think he looked younger in Bad Day at Black Rock.
It's crazy, man. John,
I think it was right before. Maybe it was right before. Maybe Bad Day at Black Rock was right before. I can't remember what year it came out.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was close. John Carradine, you know, yeah. Heavyweights. Rodano, you know, again, a fixture.
There's some great, like, actors with, like if you're an impressionist, there's, like, a lot of great impressionable actors in this.
You know? There absolutely are.
The Sterling Hayden accent, hey, friend, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, John Carradine, his kind of deep, you know, weird kind of drawl, which still sounds like some weird wakes kind of sounds like a horror drawl, even in the Western. Yeah, and then, of course, you know, Borgnine, he's got a kind of a distinctive voice and laugh and all that stuff, so.
He does.
And Mercedes Cambridge has a very unique voice for a female, for a woman.
Yeah.
To begin with. And for those who don't know, she was the, I think we talked about when we talked about the Exorcist show, but I think she did the voice of the demon in The Exorcist for William Friedkin, so.
Yeah, which, you know, it's crazy to think. She, you know, her career kind of went down the tubes. She was big in the 50s, but, and that's probably Friedkin at the time, you know, lover of film. You wanted to kind of.
She blamed Crawford.
Yeah, well, there you go.
That's what I read. She blamed Crawford, blacklisted her.
Crawford had a lot of power, and apparently she, you know, was a bit of a mean woman at times. So
yeah.
But what are you gonna do? I love when Scorsese introduces this. He says it seems like a Western. It looked like a Western, but it just, you know, it didn't quite stick. You know, but it was a hit in Europe, which I think kind of makes sense. You know, again, you know, being able to kind of deconstruct the genre, which is kind of what you get. And I think the obvious thing that we haven't even mentioned here is this is a Western, which is probably the most masculine of genres alongside the samurai film, which are interchangeable depending on culture. And your poster is this towering woman. Your star is a woman.
Yeah.
The focal point, who everyone listens to and commands respect, is a woman. This is way ahead of its time. In fact, if you were to make this film nowadays, I mean, it would be difficult to pull off something like this. We're talking 60 plus years later.
Yeah.
It'd be very
difficult. Yeah. I mean, there's been films that have tried to do it. The Quick and the Dead. There's been a couple others. But this, I don't know if that was the intention with the film. I mean, because it's a weird thing. Because, like, Joan Crawford is featured primarily in the poster. She's the star of the movie, but the movie's named Johnny Guitar, which is, you know, Sterling Hayden's character's name. So it's a very bizarre thing.
But it's more her film than his.
Yeah, it is more her film than his. And she is the tornado in the movie, the pivotal character. And Johnny Guitar is there. But it is an interesting kind of subversive thing. And, you know, I'd imagine – I don't know what it made stateside back in the day. I don't have any – again, I don't have my secret powerful weapon of the internet in front of me. But, Europeans just kind of took to it, whereas Americans, I think, were still – this is the early 50s, so we're still talking – you know, I don't know when Westerns started showing up on TV, but Westerns were very much, you know, white hat, black hat still, and – I don't even think in 54, I don't even think we were seeing any of the late cycle Bud Boddicker stuff yet or not. I don't even know.
That's, it was right around there. I think you're within a few years up or down.
Yeah. So, and you know, John Wayne was still making Westerns, and you know, we're still talking about a pretty standard Western. I mean, there's great Westerns in there, and of course, I can't think of any off the top of my head right now because I'm tired and all that good stuff, but
what you're saying, good stuff around that year?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you got Searchers and Rio Bravo both. Or was Rio Bravo 60? Maybe Searchers is like 50, right? Or 51?
I think so.
Yeah. So, I mean, you got a few heavy ones, certainly. You're still there? Okay, so I'm going to talk things. I think you did step away for a minute. So, I have to say, too, and I'd mentioned these filmmakers kind of in passing, which I guess is probably fitting, is this feels to me a little bit like a Sirkian, as in Douglas Sirk, Sirkian Western, or, you know, I could see someone like Almodovar really loving this. And they're filmmakers I really love, again, because of how they can take something that would seem like it would be kind of trite melodrama and inject it with so much humanity and subtext and subversive material, but really make it work without it seem like an agenda film, even though this, and a lot of people would say that it was sort of commentary on the witch hunt with communism, McCarthyism, and so forth.
Yeah.
A parable for that. But,
was Nicholas Ray a communist or was he part of that?
That's a good question. I know he was a theater guy. I read his biography and I can't remember now. You know, I wish I could remember, but I'm pretty sure if he wasn't, he had friends that were impacted by
everybody.
Everyone did. Sure, yeah. Well, look at, like we just said Sterling Hayden got blackballed. Did he not?
Yeah, I think he did.
Or no, maybe he didn't get blackballed, but I think he had to. It was he had to think out a bunch of people. He had to name names in order to stay.
Yeah,
one of those two things, which in turn made him cynical about Hollywood and America, which is why you see he did sort of some 70s counterculture political films.
Mm-hmm.
If memory serves, anyway.
We're not on our A game tonight.
Yeah, you know, an eye injury.
We must have went by that buffet.
We sure did. As long as we didn't eat there. But
yeah.
I love
it. I got to say, I tried the refried beans. Stay away from those.
Yeah, stay away from those, man. That's the bad move. I love when the film, when they say, you know, there's a, well, not even they don't say, but it's told to us as the viewer that there's a storm coming. And we see it's not just sort of this literal storm, there's kind of a proverbial storm coming as well.
Storm brewing on the outside, a storm brewing on the inside.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true, which I quite like. Another thing this film does too that I never noticed the first time I'd seen it is, you know, some of the close-ups and the faces and the eyes, which Sergio Leone would do. Some years later, I guess it was six, seven years later, to great effect with his trilogy. But I never really noticed a lot of the close-ups on the eyes and stuff until this time when I watched it. I think that Crawford, you know, we've mentioned that this was kind of her film in a lot of ways. And I have to say, I think she does an admirable job because I don't think, especially at the time, I don't think too many people would have had the bravado and the – you could have really pulled it off, you know, to be believable. But she really is convincing as a woman who handles her business.
She plays it pretty big but not too big.
Not cartoonish. Like it's not it's not a ridiculous performance that's just turned up to 11, you know. Like they even reference it when they say – you know, I've never seen a woman who was more like a man. She thinks like one, acts like one, and has me thinking I'm not one at times. I think that was one of the was it not Baccarat? The the gambling, one of the guys that works as the at the table for her there in her saloon. So I'll tell you what, man, there's so many fucking Colonel Sanders ties in this film.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone has one.
Did you get a hankering for some fried chicken or something, man?
Apparently, man. Yeah, I did. I was trying to say it was but everyone, including Joan Crawford, man, everyone's serious about the Colonel Sanders tie in this, which is amazing.
Yeah.
We mentioned the color palette. It's a beautiful film. Everyone, the costumes are great. This is one I want to say when I was at the LACMA, I think we might have seen her costume from this, like her yellow one. I can't remember now, but
oh really?
We might have. I can't remember now. I know we saw the Searchers and a couple of things, but there's a lot of great costumes, a really good looking film. And that's, you know, kind of when I, it's why I was getting more of a Cirque vibe at times, certainly. But, and, you know, I think that the colors are accentuated by some of the earthy tones that we see, you know, in Vienna's saloon. You know, some of the browns and clays and kind of drab colors that we see, they really pop. Pop.
I agree.
So it really looks great. And I love, too, we talked about McCambridge. I think she's great in the film, in a really thankless role, certainly. But, you know, she's kind of got this repressed desire and this kind of Puritan nature, which, you know, you can take a number of ways, a witch hunt in a number of ways, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, you could take it as elitist. You could take it as racist. You could take it as, I don't know. She's
repressed sexuality.
There's a moment of dialogue in there where I think Joan Crawford tells Sterling Hayden that she doesn't like the kid because the kid makes her feel like a woman.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know how to handle that because she's very much, you know, very tomboyish, very. This town has two women in it.
And it's, that are larger, you know, than life, just to quote the name of another Ray film.
Yeah. One of them, it's like one of them doesn't want to give it up, and the other one will give it up freely, and I guess that's making all the men in town pretty grumpy.
Yeah, well, and it's that thing, the philosophical difference between the two, certainly.
Yeah, the Madonna and the whore, maybe.
That's
I don't
right.
know.
Yeah, maybe so, certainly, and how indifferent the perceived whore is to the Madonna's perception of her.
Well, then you could get into the subversive nature, too, of the fact is McCambridge's character attracted to Vienna, you know, is attracted to Joan Crawford's character. Is that why she's so confused and angry?
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying, repressed sexuality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can get into that. You can see that, too. And I told you when we were talking on the phone, there's this moment in here where Mercedes Cambridge shoots a character and she makes a noise that has to be her real life O face.
Oh,
like behind
time.
The scenes. She's just like, oh.
I meant to say bigger than life. I said larger than life earlier. Thought I had that wrong.
I think she squirted.
Yeah, she might have, man.
not to be too crass, although that was about as crass as you can get.
yeah, but no, it did. You get that that sense of relief and this kind of exhaling from her.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a sexual release. It's very, very bizarre. There's a lot of scenes in here like that. There's a lot of scenes of these, you know, moments of violence that are almost like releases. Like, and moments that involve violence, like the turkey character, where he has to give some information up, and there's almost like, a sexual release from him. It's very strange.
Yeah, no, certainly. And, you know, Ray could have been saying some things. And, you know, I think Ray battled with his own sexual identity, you know, partially because of the times and everything else. So there could have been some kind of personal stuff being said and put on screen through the characters. I love there's some really great dialogue in this, too. It's really crackling at times. And outside of some of the crackling stuff, I love Sterling Hayden. I mean, not too many people have a delivery like him. And
I know.
He gets out and he says, you know, nothing like a good smoke and a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
All a man needs. Smoke and a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's great, man. And I love the exchange between him and the dancing kid, which think, okay, now here's the thing, too. You know, because this film has been around forever, we kind of just take it for what it is. But, you know, if I was to say two characters, would either name strike fear in your heart? Johnny Guitar or the Dancing Kid?
Not yeah, it's almost like a throwback to like the serial, like the singing cowboy type of cowboy characters, you know, the Johnny Guitar and the Dancing Kid.
Yeah,
both actors, of course, you know, are much better than the names they're handed, of course, but in the film. But there's exchanges between them that are great. There's another great dilemma of Hayden where he's like, "You care to change it? You care to change?" What kind of name is that? He's like, "You care to change it?"
Yeah, and then it pays off because a moment later he says, "What's your name? Name's a dancing kid. Do you care to change it?" You know, it's really fantastic, which is almost like.
It's macho. It's old school macho dialogue, but it isn't like that stifled kind of mid-40s to early 50s dialogue where it feels like – I mean, there's moments where it feels like people are just reading their dialogue, like going from memory, but it really feels like, you know, like almost like Tarantino dialogue.
It absolutely does, and that's what I'm saying. I feel like he was really – when I was saying that about Blast of Silence, but I feel like this is another one that he certainly would have been influenced by because the dialogue is fresh and of its time. It's – and of its time, but ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. You know, it works quite well. Ward Bond, clearly the father of J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, if they ever did a Ward Bond biopic, they should definitely get J.K. to do it, man.
Totally, man. Totally. You know, another thing I like about this film, too, is I have to feel like, you know, one of our favorite Shaw Brother films that we've covered on the show, Black Tavern, feels a little bit like this at times. Storm coming into town, a bunch of people. I mean, these are all regulars versus people traveling through and Caravan of Gold and stuff. But I feel like some of the pieces and nuts and bolts could have been extracted from this and pieced off how people saw fit for their own story. But an influence.
I haven't watched this film in quite some time. I had forgotten how much of the movie takes place outside of the tavern.
Oh, yeah. A lot of it does. Once you get past that early, maybe about 30, 40 minutes in, it's a two-hour film pretty much. So.
Yeah, and the tavern is such a great set. Like,
it's a beautiful set, man.
It looks amazing. It's like built against a rock face. You know, it's got all these really cool tables and and chandelier and all this kind of great stuff. It just looks great, and I just wanted to stay in there. And then, of course, when it goes away, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. It does go away, and we end up in this other location. And this location, I was like, I forgot all about that.
Yeah, no, it's true.
It is kind of a shame that it doesn't kind of stay in that kind of one location. I mean, I think, you know, some films, Tarantino's making The Hateful Eight this year, which is going to go to one location. And, you know, Reservoir Dogs was kind of one location. I think some of these one location films, if the dialogue's real crackling like it is in this one, I think it can work. Now, once the posse's formed and you have all of these exterior characters, it can no longer be a one location film.
No, I can't contain it.
Yeah, it gets too big.
Yeah, it does.
So you do have to get outside and everything else. But if they would have kept the initial mob kind of there and some other things, it would have been fine. But, I mean, I'm glad in hindsight they get out because, you know, you get some nice scenery. And I like the dynamiting scenes and the waterfalls and all that stuff.
I think the nighttime stuff in this is some of my favorite photography. Ray has a real knack for shooting nighttime stuff. Like, there's some stuff with a near hanging and – I mean, it's just amazing. It's really
good. He's got some good nighttime stuff with Rebel Without a Cause and all that stuff, too.
Yeah, he totally does. He totally does. Like you had said, it's bizarre that 2 weeks out of, I think, well, maybe 2 weeks out of two, we've covered Westerns that had beautiful and memorable saloons between
That's not the only weird thing about the last 2 weeks. The last 2 weeks we've done that, and we've done two films in a row scored by Pino Donaggio.
Which, yeah, somehow that happened. Yeah. It's very interesting. Man, I got a lot of notes. I'm going to try to pare it down here.
Let's talk about the gang a little bit. Let's talk about the gang of four.
Yes.
The Dancing Kids gang. We get the Dancing Kid, which I think – I can't remember that actor's name, but he was in a lot of
Brady,
TV.
Brady.
Yeah, he was on a lot of TV when I was growing up. Of course, Ernest Borgnine, who's given us another great character. Borgnine always gives you great characters. You know what you're going to get with Ernest Borgnine. This is a one of his truly despicable characters, this one, though.
Yeah, because I always find it peculiar when he plays an outright villain.
Yeah.
But this is one of them. Yeah. He's a pretty unrepentant piece of
shit. This is one where he's really nasty. I mean, you know, there's something that happens later in the film that, you know, is just really nasty. And if you've never seen it before, that's why I'm not giving it away. I think it comes as a shock.
Yeah.
That actor who played Turkey, he's still alive. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's got a great kind of head of red hair.
Ben Cooper.
And then, of course, Royal Dano, who, if you guys don't know who Royal Dano is, I think most horror movie fans will know who Royal Dano is.
And if you don't know, you do know.
Yeah, because he's popped up in, like, late-cycle VHS rental stuff, like Critters, I think, and, like, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, stuff like that.
You know who I always mix him up with is the dude that was in Angel. He played the old cowboy in that.
Oh, yeah. Was Rory – is Rory Calhoun?
Rory Calhoun a little bit. Rory Calhoun a little bit.
Yep. Yeah. But he kind of became a late-cycle, like, horror movie character actor, kind of like John Carradine.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But he's in here, and when he got older, he kind of had a unique delivery in the way he delivered lines and stuff, and a very odd character. And here he's pretty normal compared to what he's normally known for. But this is a good gang. I like this gang. You know, the Dancing Kid's a weird leader because he's very clean cut, and he comes to a weird, you know, his logic to do what he does seems a little desperate in my opinion. But
yeah.
Because he's got a propel all of a sudden he's like, well, if they think we're going to do that, then we're going to do that.
I'll like, show okay. them.
Yeah. You know. Like, I don't know if you know what you're getting into, but it almost feels like one of those moments where it's like, okay, we got to move the story along. Let's like the dancing
exactly.
kid.
Exactly.
A little bit more gray hat, but he never really feels as gray or as black hat as the Borgnine character.
No, he always
really feels like the leader in some ways.
He does. And you know who I really love? I haven't seen Scott Brady in too many things, but I really love him as a dancing kid in this. I feel like he, you know, he reminds me of a little bit. It's like a cross
between. You've seen him in more than you think you have.
Yeah, I'd have to go take a look, but he reminds me of a cross between Gene Kelly and Ray Liotta.
Oh, yeah, the Ray Liotta thing I can totally get, but yeah, the Gene Kelly thing too. Yeah, the Ray Liotta thing in the face, you're right, man. He really does kind of look like Ray Liotta, doesn't he?
Yeah, he really does to me. He really does. I guess he was Sheriff Rank in Gremlins.
That was his last credit, yeah. He was the sheriff in Gremlins. That was the last thing he did.
Strange behavior. I'll have to take a look. I'm sure I've seen him in a number of things.
Oh, you've seen him in stuff. Yeah, you have, trust me. He's one of those character actors that had kind of matinee looks, and you know they kind of disappear in the background. I can't think of any role he had that was huge. I think he may have been on a TV show for a while that might have been pretty big, but I can't think of him being like you know a superstar.
From The Rock, like he was an up and, for a number of years.
Yeah, maybe he was an up and comer, and just never really kind of reached that kind of pivotal leading man type because he has leading man looks, right?
But he
just
never really.
Never really kind of got there. Like, you know, Sterling Hayden was immediately kind of plucked out and put in because he's 6 foot, you know, 4 or 6 foot 5 and got a weird delivery and a look and everything.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. I like the kids' gang, though. I feel like Ray gets men in a way that, you know, some male directors don't have the insight to honestly look at men, but I feel like he makes them kind of real and vulnerable and clumsy and prideful. Mm-hmm. Which can be the downfall of a lot of men.
Yep.
You know, but
yeah, because you get the pride of Borgnine, the kind of clumsiness of the turkey character.
Yeah, you absolutely
the
do.
The kind of a vanity of this dancing kid character.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely.
And, absolutely. Of course, the Royal Dano character is more of like a kind of a schlump, kind of a, you know, he's evidently sick and, you know, he's got some lung problems and things like that. So he's kind of a. Everybody kind of. He's kind of a lovable bad guy or something. Well, not even a bad guy, because, like I said, technically. They don't start out the film as what I think is bad guys because it's never even really discussed, I don't think, who actually commits the initial robbery at the beginning.
No, I think, yeah, I think they just kind of leave that intentionally vague to a degree to give us, you know, propulsion.
I don't recall them coming back to it at any point in the film, like saying, aha, it wasn't them, it was Ward Bond all along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I think so, but I think Ray's smart enough to... He doesn't fixate on something that to him is going to get in the way, sort of needlessly, you know, expository. Another thing he does too, though, that's interesting is he puts the good guys in black, quote unquote, good guys in black in this.
Yep.
Which is interesting. All the exteriors look good as well as the interiors. Overall, just a really well shot film.
Another little piece of tidbit I found out was Joan Crawford didn't. She wouldn't shoot any outdoor scenes in close-up. She only would do interior scenes because she wanted the lighting to be perfect for her face.
Yeah, I can imagine. Vain and old is a terrible mix. There is a really great shot of Joan Crawford, though, speaking of which, where she's in white playing the piano.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it looks beautiful. It's a beautiful, really beautiful sequence.
It's a great scene.
And I feel like all of the scenes, you know, Crawford's a great actress. Let's give her dues, even though she could have been a tyrant. By all accounts, was I feel like when she's in a dress in the film, she is through her body language and just her delivery is more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's you know she's an old school actor. I think she you know she for the era she acted in and when she was at her prime, she was great. I think you know of course, like a lot of those great actresses or even actors nowadays, you know once you get past a certain era of acting. You tend to fall, you know, by the wayside or people tend to look at your acting style as a bit bizarre.
Yep.
Things like that. You know, like everybody loved Nicolas Cage in the 80s, but by the time it got to the late 90s, everybody was like, whoa.
They were jumping off the Cage train. Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah. And that kind of happens with, you know, I think with Joan Crawford too, because through the 50s, I think she did pretty well. I think it was in the mid 60s, early 60s, things started to unravel for her.
Yeah.
Professionally.
Yeah, but I think she got into, I think, and I don't want to talk to her, I was at school, but I feel like she got into never fails. I feel like she got into alcohol, didn't she?
I don't know what. Yeah, well, I mean, I know she was an alcoholic. I think she was an alcoholic, or maybe it was drugs. I can't remember. I'm not as familiar. I've seen Mommy Dearest. I'm not as familiar with
that.
It's
a good one. As Emily?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with that as our friend Emily is, and maybe even several other of our friends. But I feel like she got into something. But she was psychologically always kind of, you know, one of those actresses who was just kind of out there. You know, she'd been working since the silent era.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had worked her way to the top, you know, kicking and screaming. And, you know, more power to her.
Mm-hmm.
She really kind of drank her own Kool-Aid, though. And that, then, you know, that can happen, you know, with people, you know, who maybe are not able to handle that kind of stuff psychologically. So.
Can lead to a tumble on the way down, which it did, right?
Yeah.
I love the line, "I never shake hands with a left-handed draw."
Oh, that's a great line. So macho, man. It is. Fucking macho.
There's so much stuff in this that's effortlessly macho. It really works well. And you can look at it kind of meta, silly way, but it works well organically as just sort of macho stuff too. And I just feel like this is a really effortless film. Like, Ray makes it look really easy with a lot of the stuff he's pulling off and the beauty of the film. And it just works quite well. I'm going to, for this, in the interest of time.
Yeah. And eyeball pain.
And I had a mishap where I had to flush my eyes out immediately before the episode. So
for our listeners behind the scenes, he was interviewing Peter North and things went south. Actually, they went north.
They went north. Yeah. They certainly did, man.
He had been eating too many pineapples and
The pH levels were off. Yeah. Clearly.
Like those pool tubes. That thing wasn't blue, man. It was like dark purple.
Oh, man. That's not good.
Not good anyway, I don't really have a whole lot more to add. I've always loved this film. I think it's just, even though it's quote-unquote a subversive type Western, for me, it works as a pure Western as well.
Absolutely. I think it works both ways, and that's kind of the genius of it.
Yeah. And it's one of the most entertaining of the old school pure Westerns, the Westerns of the 50s. The Westerns of the 40s were a little different, but the Westerns of the 50s and early 60s were most of the Westerns I grew up with, because that's the ones my grandfather would watch, and we watched a lot of TV Westerns as well at that time. So the only way I ever saw this, I never saw it in any kind of rental capacity. I only ever saw this thing as like a recording off of TV or on TV, and it would come on occasionally. But hardly ever. But I always remembered it because you always remember the title Johnny Guitar.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that it was a female lead was very memorable. You know, of course, I couldn't process this stuff at a young age.
No.
But even I thought, you know, this is unique and kind of odd. So when I got older and got into movies and stuff a lot more, I thought, man, you know, whatever happened to that film? Then come to find out it's a cult movie. I'm like, wow, you know, that's kind of weird. Why is it a cult movie? And then I start reading about it and all this first stuff, Nicholas Ray and all these things. And, you know, all these things I didn't know Nicholas Ray did. I didn't know that he was this pivotal, you know, director working with sexual themes and things like that in film. You know, I just thought he was, you know, the guy that did a James Dean movie.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it.
You know, because he's forever tied to, you know, Jimmy Dean in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's much more than that. But this film, I think, works as just like pure entertainment as much as it, and like we were saying, macho and stuff. I mean, there's so many great lines, so many great moments. The Borgnine Hayden fight is nasty. Borgnine looks like he smells like shit.
Oh,
he just looks filthy.
Yeah.
Maybe the one of the greatest actors that pulls off dirty better than anybody is Ernest.
Yeah,
Borgnine.
Just sweaty, cheesy, crack of his ass smells hot and sour like it's nobody's business.
Yeah. He could stick his finger down his crack and just spread that shit on crackers.
Oh, man.
Oh, getting back to the Peter North stuff there.
Yeah, no kidding.
But yeah, there's some really great macho posturing. I like to see. He's like, you wouldn't shoot a man in the back, would you?
Yeah.
You know, little Sterling Hayden moments.
Yeah, that was
I keep
good.
Picturing him with a bottle of brew, you know, always drinking out of a cup, because every interview I've ever seen him, he's always drinking like something and mixing it and swirling it around with his arm. He always does that, you know.
Yeah.
I've noticed when I put a cup of coffee in a thermos mug or something, I won't mix the I'll put a little creamer in there, and I won't mix the creamer with a straw or spoon. I'll just put the top on because it's got that sealed top, and I'll just kind of spin it around, and I'll sometimes around the house do my Sterling Hayden. Yeah, you see?
House coat.
My son's looking at me like, what's wrong with you?
Until a small German man of 4 foot nine slaps you and brings you down to earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Henry Gibson was his kryptonite.
And he sure was.
No doubt about it. Yeah, but the McCambridge character, we laughed and joked around. I mean, she is easily one of the biggest bitches in the history of cinema. I mean,
she's pretty horrific in this.
This is an angry character.
She is. And, you know, she has to really bring her A game and turn it up to 11 because she's dealing with a larger-than-life figure in real life and in terms of the mythology of the film with Joan Crawford as Vienna.
And she feels like she's more like that classic actor, and Ward Bond's got a little bit of lines of dialogue like this as well, where it kind of comes across as like the 30s and 40s dialogue. Like when McCambridge delivers her dialogue, because she's got a unique voice, the way she delivers it, for me, it's very kind of stilted. It's kind of very straightforward. But it kind of works for a character because her character is so kind of unisexual and kind of appalling that she's almost like a robot in some weird way. I mean, she gives a good performance in the film. I don't doubt that at all.
No, she is good.
But it's just one of those characters that you just, you know, I don't think you love to hate. I think you hate to hate. I mean, you just hate her, you know, because she
you totally do.
Nothing makes any the anger she has is just sometimes so.
Oh, turn it down, sister. Like, fuck, man.
Yeah, I mean, even like Ward Bond's looking at her sometimes like, do we really want to do this? I mean, come on, guys, let's get a beer.
Yep.
You know, that's what you feel like sometimes, you know. I wish there was more Carradine in it. I really like the scenes between Carradine and Hayden. Those are really great.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wish there was more of that. I like the scenes between Carradine and Crawford as well. But, you know, John Carradine's a great actor who made bad movies. So that's
right, man. He sure did.
Yeah, that's just the case. I mean, you know, that happens. Let's be honest. That's not he won't be the last great actor that makes bad movies toward the back end of his career.
Not even close.
You know, not even close. He will not be the last one. But yeah, I really liked and enjoyed this. I do think the transfer looks really good for this type of movie. I do still feel like there's like a major – I don't know. I don't know if it was ever majorly restored, but I still feel like there could have been a major restoration in some ways. But I think this is as good as it's going to look. I mean, I didn't see no scratches or cigarette burns or any of those kind of type things. No pops, nothing like that. It looks pretty clean.
It does look quite good, I think. But yeah, I'm with you. I feel like when we see some films, like even Searchers, again, I hate to keep going back to that, but Western of the era that really hangs over everything. I mean, that Blu-ray is one of my favorite Blu-rays in my collection. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, this is up to par with that. But, you know, how much that's what, you know, the film, the stock, or how cared this, taken care of this was. I mean, Ray, again, wasn't really considered all that well received until the French New Wave, kind of the Cahiers de Cinema guys were really repping for him, which, you know, made people reconsider what they were looking
for. Right. It's very interesting that I think the Blu-ray, what it does do, it gives you two things when sometimes with older films. Sometimes it gives you more noticeable makeup on actors and actresses.
Yep.
And in this case, Crawford, I could really see a lot more makeup than I've ever really noticed before.
Oh, yeah.
And then it also gives you like matte paintings and things like that they would use for backgrounds and cameras or in studio and stuff like that, or back projection.
Yep.
There's some serious back projection at one point in this when they're riding in a what's those things called? I can't even think what they're called.
Off the top of the head. Wagon?
Yeah, the kind of wagon thing.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me tonight? I can't even think what
it's
the fuck.
Late.
I've watched 1,000 westerns. I can't think of what the fucking wagon is. Jesus. Anyway, but, you know, that kind of stuff really stands out in Blu-ray. I've kind of noticed that in watching high-definition transfers of kind of older movies and stuff, that sometimes that stuff stands out. And that has to do with the lighting probably and things like that. Sometimes effects will do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, some of the newer films, some of the effects really on some of the mid-90s, early CGI stuff, some of the effects on the Blu-ray stuff looks a little dodgy. But, again, you know, nobody really knew that was going to come around and stuff. And whereas, you know, a film that was just made last year looks amazing now because, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it seems like it's made for high definition, whereas these other films were kind of like the in-between period. So these older films can look great, though. I mean, we have done a few films on the show where they've looked outstanding.
It's true.
So. But, yeah, I don't have a whole lot more to add, man. I think I like the slipcase that comes in. It's a nice you know, I've never owned this film, so I'm glad I finally own it, and it's one I'll watch over and over again. It's It's got a few moments, I think, that maybe it kind of meanders a little bit.
Yeah, it could chew about 10 or 15 minutes, I think. Yeah. That's a fair statement.
Yeah, because there's just some moments where, you know, I just don't see what any benefit to some of the kind of just riding around. I mean, I think the escape through the canyon, that goes on way longer than it needs to.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because, I mean, they ride all the way up just to turn around. And, you know, by that time, Turkey's been hit. But, you know, anyway, I don't want to get into all that because it could get into spoilers and things. But, yeah, let's just hear your make or breaks and MVTs.
Nice. My make or break is a scene at night with the near hanging. I really love that scene. I think it's great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's the one with the Sterling Hayden stunt double that almost misses the horse.
Yeah. I love that scene.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing.
It is a good scene. It is a good scene.
Really good stuff. It gives us kind of classic thrills. It, you know, it's well done from a technical standpoint. Really dig it. MVT is Ray, man. I mean, he brought it with this. You know, could go with a number of things, people, but Ray was the ringleader that brought this all together. So I got to give it to him.
Yeah, I agree.
My score is an 8 out of 10. I think this is a great film. I'm glad I own it. It's interesting to see, you know, it in the context of American Westerns or just film in general. And like I said, how subversive and fascinating it was.
What do you think? Top 25 American Western? Top 50?
Yeah, I would definitely go top 25. And in fact, I would go top 10 maybe. Well, maybe 10 to 15 kind of most important.
When you start getting in the top 10, it gets pretty tough. I was going to ask you that first, and then I thought,
25 is fair, but I think top 15 in terms of importance because of – I think if you don't get something like this subverting genre and genre expectations, you may not get Leone as much. I mean, you know, he, you know, Lean and everything else that he influenced him with kind of their epic nature, but – I feel like you need people to get the ball rolling. And then if you don't get people like Nicolas Ray subverting genre, then you don't get the French New Wave. You don't get as much of a statement from these filmmakers who are influenced. And I think this film is important in terms of its influence abroad, you know, because of the Europeans, Italians making spaghettis and the French making crime films proper influenced by this. I think it's, you know, you can't overstate its importance, if nothing else.
Yep. Yep. I'm pretty much with you on this one. My only thing different really is my make or break. I really like the scene between the dancing kid and the Johnny Guitar. When the guns put on Johnny Guitar's hip and dancing kid's like, because that's always a great convention in Westerns when a guy finds out that a character is not who he thinks he is.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
Like, I've read about you.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good one.
Never shake hands with a left-hand draw.
That's right, man.
Yeah, my MVT is also Nick Ray. I could go with several others, though. I mean, you could go with Crawford. You could go with Hayden. You could go with Borgnine. I mean,
I really like Brady. I love Scott Brady in this, too.
Yeah, you could go with Brady. I mean, he is good. I mean, he starts out as kind of a cardboard cutout character, but he turns into a very interesting character by the end. Totally. I mean, you could even go, if you're into that kind of thing, you could even go with McCambridge, because I mean, she does give it her all.
She does.
Kill her! But the only one you can't go with is Ward Bond, who, you know, he's fine, but he's just kind of...
But he's Ward Bond. He's just...
Yeah, he just kind of stands there.
Shows up, does his thing. He Ward Bonds it up, and then...
Yeah, he's sitting there going, you know, can you play Whiplash? Anyway.
Motherfucker.
My score is the same as yours. It's an 8 out of 10. It's I think it is one of the top 25 Westerns of the American... Westerns. When you start getting into worldwide Westerns, it gets a little bit more murky.
Ooh, I'd still go top 50 for sure.
Yeah, I think I'd go top 50 for sure on that too.
Maybe top 30. I just think, it's important. And it's important to have a left field entry into that world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the greats, no doubt.
Nice.
Definitely think people should pick it up.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All it's got on their website. So we're going to take a short break. Going to shift gears. We're going to stay in the Southwest. Specifically Houston, specifically 1989?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 89.
1989 is the summer, right?
Yeah.
As a man from Long Island once said. So we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about Roy and Hook Hands and the Houston and the Astrodome.
Yeah.
So we will be right back.
No one would have believed in the first years of the 21st century, that Hammer films were being watched from an entertainment standpoint. No one could have dreamed that Amicus films were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility that this era of film still had anything to offer. And yet, across the Gulf of Space, minds immeasurably superior to our own regarded this podcast with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against it. The Amicus Podcast. Hammer and Amicus, and every tenuous link in between. Amicus.com and iTunes. Cheers.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Our final film of the evening is one that, complete opposite of the last film that we covered, Johnny Guitar, 1989's Night Game, was one that neither one of us had even heard of prior to me stumbling onto a poster, thinking of my dear friend and co-host Sammy and thinking, as I'd said in the intro, hook through a hand, or hook through a hand, hook through a baseball. Fuck, let's do it. Let's see what this is all about.
Yeah, you'll Roy have to synopsize because I can't, I don't have one in front of me, so.
Yeah, no problem. A police detective tracks a serial killer who's stalking young women on a beachfront after each game that a baseball pitcher for the Houston Astros wins. Yeah. I think that summarizes it quite well. Quite succinct.
Yeah, that's it.
I picked this film. Interesting piece of trivia. This film had never been on home video prior to Olive picking it up, which is always a cool thing to see. I think the last time we had a film like this was when The Candy Snatchers came out on DVD and it had never been on VHS prior.
I wonder if one of the earlier releases, Uptight, I wonder if that was on...
Oh, I wonder, and I love Uptight. Yeah, that's a good point, man. That's a very good point. But, and you and I had sort of theorized that perhaps this was like an HBO film or something because it kind of has that feel. I'll let you get into it here, and I'm very curious to hear your thoughts because you and I briefly spoke about it off the air, but let's see what you got to say.
Yeah, so, I put this in. You know, I didn't know what to expect. The poster's great. It's got a prosthetic hook hand going through a baseball, kind of drawn in the classic kind of mid-80s horror slasher way.
Oh, yeah.
And very much a kind of mid-80s slasher type inspired poster for sure. So I didn't know what to expect of this movie and was kind of pleasantly surprised by it, to be honest with you. It has some issues, but it was better than I expected it to be. Roy Scheider's the head cop. We should say hashtag SoGGTMC, cops answering phones and beds.
Oh, man.
Definitely.
And Roy is one of our favorites. You know, we've often said, I mean, he's been on our show before, one of the great unsung actors of our time. Just terribly underappreciated, you know, when we love him. And he's great in this.
I think it sometimes goes with the road sometimes that if you're in at some point, it seems to me like if you're in at some point the biggest movie of all time.
Yep.
That you kind of just fade away.
Yeah, look at Mark Hamill.
Yeah, Mark Hamill. Look at who I think he'll fade away too. What's his name? The guy was in Sabotage recently. Sabotage. Sam Worthington.
Yep.
I think he'll fade away slowly. I think I'm trying to think of some other ones, but I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, these actors kind of. I'm not saying that they don't do good work because they obviously do, but they never really kind of. Sam Neill, who was in Jurassic Park at one point, you know.
Yeah, who's great actor, favorite of ours, but. More kind of character actor than anything.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Roy Scheider, great. It's always great. Cops answering phones and beds. Again, that's hashtag SoGGTMC to me. Man, the cops can never get a break, man. They can't ever get a good night's rest.
They can't eat a hot dog at the stand. They can't sip their coffee at the coffee shop.
Can't ever catch a break.
They can't. They just as they're about to throw that baseball with their kid in the backyard, fucking forget it. They got to go. Yeah.
And they always have to deal with, the loved one who's like, can't you just take some time off?
Yeah.
Can't you just, can't you just take a day?
Always.
I gotta go on.
Yeah.
This one is directed by, Peter Masterson. I didn't really see anything else that kind of jumped out at me that he did. I think there was a couple, but I don't
have a couple things that looked interesting, but, he wasn't a guy with a deep resume that would have been known to a lot of people, yeah.
And the film isn't overly stylish, so that kind of shows, I think if this would have been Night Game directed by Dario Argento, first of all, he wouldn't know. Yeah, We'd have probably had a cricket thing or something, maybe something they're going. Or
we would have had soccer. We would have had soccer. Yeah. But I thought about that because I'd said to you, I feel like this film very much is an American giallo. This kind of bonkers, forgive the pun, this bonkers hook for a murder mystery. And even the way it's finalized with a lot of psycho babble and, you know.
And a great scene of somebody losing their mind at a bar. Man.
It's amazing.
Like, if nobody knows who the killer is, at that point, everybody knows who
everybody
the killer is.
Everybody fucking knows.
Like, what's wrong with this fucking guy, man? Is he Total Recall before it even came out?
Yeah, totally, dude.
So we get a saxy. I mean, I'm talking saxy score from Pino.
Pino brings the saxy thunder, which is, again, very GTTMC. And I'd said to you, and you sort of replied, I said, I love it even though it doesn't feel organic, but you said it does feel very detective.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah.
I think some of the nice touches I liked about this movie was it really nailed the summer, right? I don't know if it was shot in the summer, but it nailed the summer. Everybody's body has a nice kind of fine humidity-based kind of sweat on it.
Fucking greasy, sweaty film.
Yeah, I'm getting a phone call. I got a second.
Man, Pac-Man time. You just ate the fruit. But Sammy was right in saying that this one is a very sweaty film. You know, early on, with crime scenes and close-ups of people's faces and stuff, everyone's very oily and sweaty, and it just seems like we talked about the dancing kid with our last film, but I feel like we get a lot of Crisco kids this time around that have just decided to massage Crisco into their face and neck and back and and just be very sweaty and oily and you know, uncomfortable. But it's par for the course. It's a Houston summer, right? So I think you're going to get that. And I'll let you continue. I was just saying that.
Thanks for vamping for me while the machine went crazy.
It's cool, man.
So, the nice touch of the sweaty bodies, like I said, it really kind of captures. I don't really know Houston weather that well, but I know the weather I'm used to in the summertime, which is not so much the oppressive heat, but the oppressive humidity, which causes this kind of misty sweatiness that's almost ever present in the summertime where I'm at. So they really know that well. We get some good character actors in this. I don't have the name of the gentleman that almost raped Billie Jean in Billie Jean, The Legend of Billie Jean.
Yeah,
he's great. He's got some great dialogue in the movie, too. I didn't write down one.
The police captain.
Yeah, he has a great line in the film that I loved, but I didn't write it down. I forgot to write it down.
Is it Richard Bradford? No.
Yeah, I don't know who it is. I can't remember. But, of course, we do get Paul Gleason in a small role, and he's great because he's, you know, as my little note says, Paul Gleason gives great asshole.
He does give.
Yeah. I don't know about the other way, but I
Oh, man. That's a great, you know, that's going to be that compliment's going to be used on someone else. I don't know much about him, but I'll tell you what, he gives great asshole.
Oh, man.
But no, you're right. Gleason does give great asshole.
There you go.
He absolutely does. And I wish, and it felt like Ford Fairlane with Ed O'Neill and Ford Fairlane a little bit, like,
yeah.
I wish we had have had more of that stuff, whether it's played a little bit light or straight face. I think that Gleason and the Scheider stuff works really well early on.
Yeah. I think the baseball stuff in the movie, it's not intrusive. That's really one of the things I liked about it. I think if it had been – in some ways, I kind of wish it – I joked with you about some things at the ending. Like, it could have been, like, crazy bonkers, and I would have loved it. But
yeah,
I'm kind of glad that they didn't, like, overdo the baseball stuff throughout the film. Like, the baseball games are on the radio, which is nice. Like, it reminds me, not that these films are comparable, but it does remind me of, like, the Mets games and Bad Lieutenant, how they're always kind of in the background, kind of giving you a
big time
run. And I really like that that angle because, you know, Scheider, he's an ex-ball player. And, you know, I guess he got an injury or something like that. So he's kind of, he's a cop, but, you know, he loves baseball. And, you know, he lives in Houston, loves the Astros, and you know, always worry about how they're doing and stuff. And it's kind of in the background and stuff. Eventually, he becomes upon a suspect, which, you know, I think his logic is completely suspect on how he falls into that. But
yes,
that's neither here nor there. I mean, again, this is a slasher/thriller/giallo type hybrid.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point, you got to get to the final chapter. So There's some good kills in this though. I mean, there's some nasty slashing, stylish.
Even though I think the direction overall isn't stylish, there are some stylish kills, and the cinematography can be stylish.
Well, they kind of go to the by adding the carnival angle, the carny angle.
I like that.
Yeah, by adding that angle, you immediately add like you add a House of Mirrors, you add a tunnel of love, whatever you want to add.
Mm-hmm.
But that immediately gives the director a little opportunity to get a little style in there, because obviously those things are kind of hat in hand when it comes to, you know, horror films sometimes. So exactly. I think it kind of works for some of the kills and things like that. Not that they all take place there. One of them takes place in kind of an empty parking lot. It kind of reminded me of like The Lost Boys or something like that.
Yeah, it did. I've got that vibe as well. And I feel like that one feels like there's tension. I feel like Masterson does manufacture some nice tension with the kills, and then we get some POV stuff, and they're kind of trying to tip us off. Oh, it's you, the killer says. No, yeah. So indicating, or the woman, the victim says, so, you know, we know the killer, which kind of adds a thing to it, which, you know, very giallo.
Yeah, it is, but POV, it's also kind of bizarre.
It is, because I think they abandon that later on.
Yeah, because they get to the end of it and stuff, and I'm like, well, how would they know? I mean, how popular was this guy, and how'd they get to that? Because, you know, he looks like fucking Al Herbosky for the old school save pitching guy, the Mad Hungarian, you know? I mean, he looks pretty wild and wacky, and he's doing, like I told you on the phone the other day, he's doing like the Hulk Hogan holding the finger up moment at the bar.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm going to get you. You
know? Oh, man, he's really – I'm getting – this was an actor that had a moment in time to fucking go for it, and he goes for it.
Well, he's popped up in a lot of stuff. He usually plays like a lieutenant or a cop. He's popped up in some Tony Scott movies and some other stuff. That's usually the stuff he does. But
well, Tony Scott likes to turn up to 11, so it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Pacing's a little off in some ways. There are some moments where it kind of, you know, I felt, you know, it kind of, I don't know. I like the relationship with Roxy. I mean, she's not a gorgeous actress, but she's
definitely not.
There's something very sexual about her and very appealing that way.
Yep.
And I like her and Shredder's relationship. I wanted more of that, but at the same time, at some point, you know, they're kind of going through turmoil and stuff, and I'm like, can we, you know, do we really need this? Can we move on from this? You know, so it's good. And that's actually, you know, it's not a huge chunk, but it's a pretty good chunk of the movie.
Yeah.
And his mom, her mom is obnoxious. And
she really is.
And Rorschach, I mean, there's a great interaction with her and him at a wedding dress fitting.
Oh, yeah.
It stands out like a sore thumb in the movie in a weird way. It's like this weird comedy beat in the movie. But, you know, it's not bad. It just kind of stands out. What works in the movie for me, though, really is, you know, Scheider and the camaraderie of the cops and all that stuff. I mean, that stuff really works. I think him and the captain have a great relationship. It's a great scene at a bar.
Absolutely, there
where
is.
He gives him a quarter to call a phone, and I love all that stuff. It's really good. You know, kind of almost macho, kind of tough guy, Western posturing again.
Oh, big time. Yeah, you totally get that with this one.
Yeah. The Blu-ray itself, there's moments where it looks really good. There's moments where it looks a little soft.
No, but
some of the city shots. But overall, it looks great.
It does. And they give us, you know, as much as this production value or whatever you want to say, I quite like some of the shots of the coastline and stuff. I feel like it really gives us a sense of where we are and isolation a little bit. I think it sets it up as a very regional thriller, which, you know, a lot of times thrillers can be kind of anonymous with a nightclub scene and bullshit. But I like it. It feels a very specific regional thriller.
Yeah, I'm assuming it was shot in the Houston area, so
yeah,
I didn't really check, but I'm assuming that. I think it's a perfectly serviceable thriller. I mean, I think some of our more horror-based fans would actually enjoy it because the prosthetic hand kills are pretty nasty, and there's some throat slashings and things like that, and it's actually a lot more aggressive and nasty than I thought it was going to be in so many ways. And I think that they'll dig it as well as, you know, just general film fans will enjoy the kind of thriller elements and stuff. If there is one thing, though, and I got to get this off my chest, that I did not like about this movie, I got to be honest with you right now, I did not like the ending.
It feels,
you know what I'm talking about? At the ball game?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, man. That's.
But again, I wonder if that's when it was like made for TV. Like, it's
very tactile. It's a little too, you know, ha ha ha, cue laugh track.
It totally is. But again, that's TV, I guess. But no, I'm with you.
And who goes there on their wedding? I mean, I guess, you know, whatever. Yeah, but still.
I don't know. It's a bit strange, certainly.
still very odd to me. That, and it just, you know, it just, I don't, I guess the word I'm looking for is it's not awful. It's just really cheesy considering what the rest of the film was. Not that the idea of a picture with, or you know, somebody with a prosthetic hand, you know, slashing people's throats isn't ridiculous enough. But at least, you know, in the genres we watch, that's perfectly normal.
It totally is.
You know, in this, you know, that you end up at a baseball game just seems, after a wedding, seems pretty bizarre. So, I don't know.
No, for sure. For sure.
I don't think that's a spoiler either, by the way.
No. We haven't mentioned who's getting married, so.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned that. But yeah, that's all my notes.
Okay, cool.
I really did like that. I know the Pinot score, we talked about that a little bit on the phone the other day. I know like the Pinot score doesn't really fit. In some ways, the kind of Houston Galveston setting and the kind of police, because it feels more like a private eye type score. But totally. You know, even at that, it still was pretty good.
No, I really like it. Of course, sucker for the sexy.
Sucker for the sexy.
Yeah. Sucker that goes for right up the there give good giving, asshole.
Yeah, sucker for the sexy gives good asshole.
Yeah, it sure does. I bet he does, man.
Oh, man.
He'll be turning that. never mind.
These late shows are always a risky gamble for us.
Always a gong show. Major League Baseball would never do this film now.
No. You see this sometimes with these older movies.
Yeah,
before you know, Image was such a big deal. Yeah, and you see it occasionally.
I think in the film isn't Roy Scheider named Mike Seaver.
You know what? I don't remember.
I think it was Mike Seaver. And what was the pitcher for the Mets? Was it Tom Seaver?
I don't know. Wasn't Mike Seaver the name of Michael Mike J. Fox's Seaver. Dad? And
no, Mike and Seaver. Family. You're on the right track. Mike Seaver was, if memory serves, was Alan Thicke's character on Growing Pains.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Either way.
Or Mike Seaver was Kirk Cameron.
I can't remember.
I'm going to check right now. I'll tell you what, it wasn't Joanna Kearns. We know that.
That we know, yes. It wasn't her. Was that the Seaver family?
I guess it was. Yeah, it totally was.
Because Family Matters, or not Family Matters, but Family Ties was a different family.
Yeah, what were they called? The Keatons, Alex B. Keaton.
Yeah, the Keatons, there you go.
Fucking zealot. It was Kirk Cameron's character. spending all of Sister... Sister Cameron and by way are actually spending all of Valerie Bure's hockey money on evangelical Christian films, man.
Yeah.
Shameless motherfucker. Sorry, were those all your notes?
Yeah, that was it. That's all I got.
Oh, okay, good.
I mean, I got a lot more, but I know we're pressed for time.
And yeah, we totally are.
Both of us, you got eye issues for another reason, but I got eye issues because I'm just so fucking tired. So,
well, that and of course, mine is the one that I see with yours is your brown eye, and it's been turned out. And
yeah. Looks like the astronaut.
The midnight sun going sideways quick. That was my change up there, bye.
Yeah. Through the changeup, you overswung there, buddy.
Yeah, big time, man. Big time. So Spencer Eastman wrote this, right? So you said in Italy, and instead of Major League Baseball, you can have Serie A matches like Inter Milan and all this. But you, instead of Spencer Eastman, you get George Eastman to write it. And you can keep it as a sweaty movie.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of parallels here. We get a switchblade, which is great. I like that. Man, you see that police chief's got that amazing state of Texas shaped pinky ring?
Yeah.
I wonder if Davey Max got one of those, man.
He probably does. He just doesn't wear it on his pinky.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing, man.
Or maybe he does call it pinky. I don't know.
Yeah. Or purpley. Yeah. If that ring's too tight, man, you better get that ring fitted.
Yeah, it better be elastic somewhere.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Speaking of Davey Mack, I feel like he needs to see this. People like him, Christina, our friends in Houston, even though this is Galveston, and I don't know how close the proximity Galveston is to Houston, but I feel like this would feel authentic to them because, the you know, the time well, it's got to be relatively close because they're cheering for the Strohs, right? So
Yeah. No, I agree. I'd like for our, kind of our Southwest, our kind of Texas brethren to kind of check it out and see what they think.
Yeah, totally. I feel like the special effects in this are good. Like, the kills do get nasty, like we said, and the kills are very good. They're serviceable. Another week, another cop debriefing with a slideshow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Like, man, when slides became technology, man, cinema overused them.
They did.
Completely.
Complete with the
I remember thinking slideshows were so amazing. I remember when I was a kid, I remember thinking, man, that's amazing. Get all my pictures put on slides one day.
Oh, totally, dude. Totally. Now, I have to ask you, Excedrin, we've never had that in Canada. Is it still made there?
Yeah, I believe it is. Yeah.
Is it okay? The chief in this with the Texas pinky ring reminds me of a cross between the owner of the Double Deuce and that's who he reminded me of, actually, the owner of the Double Deuce, Lockstack, yeah, okay. Lost.
Kevin Teague,
that's right, man. How about this, you know, minutia? How small were coffee cups then compared to now?
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, and just what's amazing is this is in Texas. Everything's bigger in Texas.
Well, everything's bigger, including the Daisy Dukes, man. Those girls were they faux pas. They brought the baggy Daisy Dukes back.
Yeah, so the Amber Heard Dukes.
The Amber Heard Dukes, man. Roy Scheider, very, very smooth cat. He gets mother and daughter in this.
Yeah.
Not only does he get mother and daughter, but we get to see and someone's going to make a gif of this. An amazing clip of Roy Scheider cutting a rug at the club, man. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. They needed to cast him in Cruising. Yeah. Yeah, he had energy. You know, here's the thing I love about Roy Scheider.
He had an Astros ring around his blowhole.
Oh, big time, man. Big time. I feel like Roy Scheider is the kind of actor, much like when we talked about, you know, Robert Zadar, rest in peace. And a lot of our favorites, no matter what material they were working with. Because I think that Scheider's late cycle kind of sleazy, fun, kind of canon 52 pickup and that thriller at Niagara Falls we were talking about the other night. And this, I feel like he – and even when he was sick, I think he was on his deathbed when he made it, Cohen and Tate. I mean, he brings it every time out, man. He's never half-assing it. Yeah. God bless Roy Scheider for that. I think this – like we said, this Blu-ray looks good. I think it sounds solid. There's a great line in here, made me think of you when someone says, "Oh, come on, he's just a harmless panty sniffer."
Well, that's you know, that's me.
Yeah, there you go, man. That's amazing.
Over at Davey Mack's place.
Yeah, that's right, man. Scheider's got again. You could turn him into Inspector Tansy because he's got a strong pimp hand.
Yeah, he does.
Very strong pimp hand. I like the carnival shots. You mentioned that. He fucking loves his recliner, man. He loves his
recliner. Yeah. Such a man's man. You know, recliners, cigarettes, alcohol, and baseball.
Yeah. Members only jackets at one point.
But that's in the hot summer. That recliner, you know, it smells like ass.
Oh, it gets back to that Borgnine crack, man. The Borgnine crack phenomenon. Yeah. The Borgnine crevice. Yeah, no, definitely it does. What is it? It's, speaking of which, doesn't someone say, "How'd you like to kiss my black cat's ass?"
Yeah, I think somebody does say that, yeah. That's
a great line. Creepy layer at the back end, kind of.
And kind of, yeah. It's kind of weird. I thought that stuff really didn't start popping up until like 7, like, you know, like 5 years later.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Which but is crazy when I think about it. I think 7 was 90. Was it 94 or was it 96?
Oh, I'm going to say 96.
Okay. Maybe it was 96. I seem to think it was 94. But anyway, either way, I've always associated the creepy layers with 7, it seems like. And it seems like the influence of those. But obviously, they came before that.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, for sure. We could keep going. Like you had said, I was very pleasantly surprised with this one. You know, didn't expect much. 95, we split the difference.
Yeah, way better than it Okay, so 95. Okay,
seven. So, yeah. I said 96. You said 94. We split the difference.
So, wow, that's only 6 years after this film. That's crazy.
And that feels so much newer than this.
I know it does. I know.
All right, so let's get to Maker Breaks and MVTs and all that good stuff.
All right, my Maker Break is kind of, I know it's kind of a cheat in a way, but it's the reveal. Because that scene at the bar, that scene at the bar is amazing. I mean, I wish I could make a gif of that, but it would give away too much.
It looks like that guy is as animated as Eastman eating pubes in Anthropophagus, man.
Yeah. He's really excited. I mean,
dude, is he ever.
Like, they make that substitution, he just goes fucking bananas.
Oh, see, again, they could make it like if in Italy the Serie A soccer team, where Eastman would be like the goalie, like Gianluigi Buffon, the goalie for Italy's national team, and his eyes go wide. He goes crazy.
Yeah. It's totally that kind of acting. It's George Eastman's school of acting. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, it'd be amazing.
My MVT for the film is the location. I don't know exactly where it is. I like Scheider a lot in the film, but I like him in a lot of stuff. So
yes,
I could give it to him easily, but I really like Scheider. The location that's shot in and stuff gives it's a nice summery, beachy kind of feel.
Totally.
Really, coastline, really kind of encapsulates that. You kind of feel the heat while you're watching it. So
you do.
It's really nice. My score for the film is a 7 out of 10. I enjoyed it. It's a lot more than I thought it was going to be. I mean, it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not a masterpiece, but it's a hell of a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
You've seen the future of 80s thrillers, and its name is Peter Masterson?
Yeah.
No, but you're right.
It's competent. His direction is perfectly fine. That's the thing about the movie. Everything about it is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Without being something that I would throw in people's face.
Yeah. It all comes back to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Masterson gives a great asshole.
No doubt, man. No doubt.
Embarrassing. Another embarrassing night recording.
Olive, don't hate us. Don't give up. Don't give up on us, baby. my make or break, I'm going to go with I forgot it and I closed my book. That's embarrassing. I'm going to cheat also. There it goes, man. I want to get a white felt t-shirt. No, a white felt t-shirt. A white t-shirt with that old school black felt lettering that says, actually, I can't wear this. I have kids. And I'm an adult now. I give a great asshole.
It had to be a white shirt with a really long zipper around the middle. That's what it is.
No doubt, man. If you can make like varsity jackets. It'd be amazing. But I'm going to go with The Killings because I feel like The Killings are strong in this. They're intense. They're stylish. They're really good. Like, they're exceptionally heavy for this kind of thing. A lot of times when you get murder mysteries and thrillers from the 80s and 90s, unless they're the ones that we all really know and love, this, you know, they don't usually go for the gusto. They usually fall flat. They're really dull and boring. But this one fucking goes for it, which I really appreciate.
Surprising.
Yeah, it totally was. MVT, I agree that Galveston, Houston, this coastal area is fantastic, and I love, love, love it. But I'm going to go with Scheider because I feel like if we had have had a Dullard in the lead, it just kind of would have squandered things. But I feel like Scheider really keeps it – he's lively. He keeps things moving, and, you know, we're behind his character, and, you know, he's really good. But very close second is the setting. It's a great setting and kind of a great, unique, kind of bizarro setup, so – yeah, like you said, it's a nice little disc, bare bones, but again, it looks great. And you and I spoke about this off the air. I'll definitely revisit this through this of this. It looks good, man.
It's a super rewatchable movie.
It absolutely is.
What was your score for the movie?
My score is a touch higher than yours. It's a 7.25.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, solid, solid stuff. So, that's everything. Why don't you tell everyone what we're covering next week?
Oh, yeah, next week we're back to the Diabolik DVD. Heading back into the world of the Diabolik DVD sponsorship.
Yes.
And we're going to be covering a couple of movies that start with C, because that's as far as I could get in the catalog, I guess. I didn't even notice that until after I got them.
Nice.
But we're going to be doing Sergio Corbucci's Habaneros.
Nice.
Which is something we've kind of held off on for a long time, but we're going to be doing the Blu-ray of that. And we're going to be doing John Carpenter's Christine.
Wicked.
Which is another one we've kind of held off on for a long time because it was only really readily available on Blu-ray by Twilight Time, but now it's there's a German release as well.
Mm-hmm. Spend those hard-earned Deutschmarks. And I think if I'm wrong, this is an upgrade for both of us from DVD to Blu for both these films, I think, right?
Yes, it is.
That's a cool – yeah, very cool.
Yeah, these are upgrades. We already know – people already know how we feel about Corbucci, so.
Oh, yeah, and I'll tell you
this. People already know how we feel about Carpenter, so.
Two of our favorites. And ironically, not only do the films start with C, but the directors are with C.
Yeah, that's so weird. I don't even know how that happened.
And I can tell you the Christine DVD I have, talk about major upgrades, it's one of those old cardboard cases with the snap-in.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Christine I got. So, or is it? Nice. Anyway. But anyway, so yeah, we're going to be back next week. Two masters of their respective genres, and a number of genres for that matter. Mm-hmm. And again, we want to thank Olive for the opportunity to make crass, ridiculous, punch-drunk jokes and supply us with some great films. And in all seriousness, head over to Olive Films. Check out their catalog. It's a deep, varied catalog. There's lots of wonderful stuff over there. Support them. I can promise you they're doing right by us in every regard. They've been a joy to deal with. So thank you again to them. And, I guess with that being said, with barely any eyes open, including the brown eyes,
I just passed my Texas shape ring.
That's amazing. Ooh, man. Hope you don't lose that thing in there, man. Ooh.
The East Texas panhandle got a little rough.
Yeah. Handled that pan.
Oh.
We better jump off here, man.
All right, man. Adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.